end. Would you like to reserve some rebuttal time?
Yes, 3 minutes, please.
Certainly.
May it please the court, I am here on behalf of Edward Zinner, the appellant in this case. Mr. Zinner was charged and convicted of felony hit and run and DUI in the Virginia Beach Circuit Court. The crux of my assignment of error was that for the DUI, there was testimony of an expert toxicologist by the name of Dr. Connie Lucky. Dr. Lucky was permitted to testify to retrograde extrapolation that ultimately provided an extremely high BAC of a 0.27.
But tell me, counsel, specifically, where did the expert testify that this defendant's blood alcohol would be whatever at the time of the accident?
Well, it was interesting because as the Commonwealth attorney would ask the questions, Dr. Lucky, who has testified hundreds of times in the Virginia Beach courts, kind of modifies her answer to then say, well, this would be a normal person or this would be a normal person. But then the Commonwealth doesn't reference that in their closing arguments.
But then she then said, well, I don't know because I need to know when they last consumed the alcohol and a number of other factors. So go back to my question. Where in the record does it say that this defendant's blood alcohol at the time of the accident was X?
It's not explicitly stated, but it is implied. And it's implied based on the fact that she says she doesn't know all these factors, but that if she does the retrograde extrapolation for a normal person under normal factors, then this is what you get. And the Commonwealth adopts that.
But her testimony also was, we don't know if this was the normal person.
Absolutely, and that's the problem, because we have an individual who's testifying as an expert, who's seemingly qualified in the field, and yes, we have to speculate about every single aspect of her calculation.
But it seems to me, Ms. Pauly, and I will look at the Commonwealth certainly made a big deal about this expert testimony applying to this defendant in its closing argument, but it seems to me your biggest hurdle in this case is not so much whether the expert's witness testimony was admissible, but why it wasn't harmless error, given the fact that he was at the scene of the accident, smelled of alcohol, unsteady on his feet, all the indications of being intoxicated, and that hours after, without having consumption in the meantime, he had a blood alcohol of, what, 0.21, I think it was? I mean, why is the fact that he might have been 2.7 at the time of the accident, not just harmless, given the fact that he was still well over the 0.08 limit hours after it occurred?
Well, I think the number that was provided by Dr. Lucky was a number that was very heavily weighed upon by the Commonwealth, and I think that that has a tendency to shock the conscience or sway the court in a direction, because we see DUIs all the time. 0.08 is our standard number for what is our level of intoxication. Here we're at potentially a 0.34, and that's
0.34.
Just... Yes.
But he was 2.1 well, hours after, so he's clearly over the 0.08 at the time of the crime.
Well, he's a 0.21 at the time that he's found in the bushes. I think that's the weirdest part about this case, is that you have a 6.5 to 7 hour period where you don't know what he's doing. And when he
but
gets.
There's no evidence that he consumed alcohol in that period, is there?
There's really no evidence to what he did at all. We
well,
just
if
simply
he consumed
don't know.
Alcohol, all of this would be. All, none of this would be admissible. So.
Yes, and there was no evidence that came in at the trial to say that he had consumed evidence, no evidence that placed, or alcohol, no evidence that placed him in a bar, no evidence that placed him with a bottle in his jacket when he was found by the police. So that's what's troubling about it, is you have to take this number that you have at 1 a.m. and ultimately go back to a 7 p.m. crash and attribute that it's the alcohol that caused the accident. The factors regarding the accident are actually very slim. We know from reckless driving cases that an accident alone is not sufficient to say that an individual is driving recklessly. There was very little evidence testified to about how the accident occurred. Neither driver in either car testified. So you had no testimony from Mr. Zinner, and you had no testimony from Mrs. Kotke. She simply was the driver, and it was her husband who said, "We pulled out and we got hit." There was no testimony to speed. There was no testimony to whether or not this type of vehicle is likely to flip or turn.
Your assignment of error has nothing to do with the sufficiency of the evidence. It has to do with the admissibility of the testimony.
Well, my second assignment of error did go. Yes, sir. And in terms of the harmless error portion, if the court takes out the 0.27 to 0.34 testimony, I believe it was Your Honor's question as to what the other evidence would be for intoxication. I don't think the accident alone is sufficient to say that he was intoxicated. Well, then what you have is you have an odor of alcohol, and we have cases that say that odor alone is not sufficient. It is not illegal to drink and drive as long as the amount of alcohol that you have in your system does not affect your mannerisms and your speech and your muscle movement.
If it's 0.08, you could be Mario Andretti, but you can't drive.
Exactly. But we don't know that if you take out the retrograde extrapolation.
Explain to me how he can be a 0.21 hours after the accident and not be over 0.08 at the time of the accident.
Well, there's a problem because we don't know what he did in the interim.
But there's no evidence, again, of any consumption of alcohol in the interim. So the logical conclusion is he was at least 0.21 at the time the accident occurred.
Potentially. But again, there's no evidence to support that either way. And that's why
except that he told the officer that he had nothing to drink since the accident.
He also told the officer he didn't quite remember the accident, or initially when the officer appeared, he couldn't have.
The light most favorable to the commonwealth.
As you should. But he says a lot of different things. You know, was anybody hurt? I mean, that would be a really unusual question when you have a car that's in front of you.
We're talking about the fact finder evaluating the evidence of whether or not he was telling the truth, whether he had an opportunity to observe. But he did say to the detective that he had nothing to drink since the accident.
And when you look at the testimony of the detective as a whole, you'll see that it's a kind of all over the place in terms of what Mr. Zinner is able to communicate at that point. I agree with that. But even the fact finder, when she's looking at that, she doesn't know what has happened in the interim. If he had showed up right at the hospital after the accident and that's his BAC, this is no question. But he's face down in some bushes 7 hours later. And at that point in time, there's nothing to say where he's been or what he's been doing. I think the problem is Mr. Kopke, and what the Commonwealth wants to attribute is, well, Mr. Kopke saw him stumble a little bit when he got out of the car. I don't think you can attribute that to alcohol necessarily when you look at the totality of the accident of itself. Mr. Kopke, in a very 1 or 2 seconds that he interacted with Mr. Zinner, felt that he smelled an odor of alcohol. And then you have the accident itself. So if you look at those factors alone, I don't think that they're sufficient to get you to the DUI. What gets you to the DUI is the fact that Dr. Lucky is testifying and the Commonwealth is attributing that testimony to Mr. Zinner in her closing argument. She says in two separate places that this is the BAC that Dr. Lucky says was a 0.27 to a 0.34, and she attributes that to Mr. Zinner. And then Judge Shockley indicates, for all the reasons the Commonwealth has stated, in essence, I'm going to find that he is guilty of the DUI, which shows that she relied on those arguments about the 0.27 to the 0.34.
Let me ask him, and I don't know the question is because I was just thought came to my mind. Did the expert testify, the expert testified as to the effect of alcohol on an individual at various levels?
Yes.
Is that correct? Was that testimony based on a level of 0.21, or was it based on a level of 0.34?
I believe she did both. So I believe on cross-examination, she was asked to testify to 0.34. And this is what's puzzling, is I believe it was Mr. Andrews, trial counsel at the time, who asked her would he be able to even walk at that particular
time. We do have testimony in the record as the impairment one would have at a blood alcohol level of 0.21.
Yeah. Yes, I believe so, because the Commonwealth tried to say, well, at this 0.21 level, what things would we see regarding slurred speech, the ability to walk, the ability to drive?
And I ask that because you're correct. I was just looking at the indictment. He was not indicted for driving at a 0.08 or above. He was solely indicted for driving under the influence.
Yes.
Which is, as you correctly stated, is simply an observation apparent to a normal person. The impairment portion of that.
And the problem is we really have very limited interaction with him at the time of the accident in order to determine whether or not he's under the influence at the time. That's where your hit and run comes in. And at that point, him leaving the scene doesn't give officers who are trained in the observations of DUI and alcohol-related offenses to know, is he someone who is stumbling because he's drunk, or is he stumbling because he was just in a very serious particular accident?
But the bottom line, in terms of assumptions, that she said she can't make that assumption, is because she doesn't know basically the absorption rate. She doesn't know what he drank prior to the accident or how long before the accident he drank. So based on that, didn't she say that I really can't make that decision, because without that assumption, she's going to they would falsely elevate the concentration of blood alcohol.
Yes, she absolutely says that. And like I said, I think the Commonwealth was driving her in one direction. She's a professional, and she very well knows what she can and cannot attest to. But when your entire testimony is based on assumptions and hypotheticals, then she provides nothing regarding the defendant himself. The problem is the Commonwealth then takes that opinion and manipulates it to directly go towards Mr. Zinner, and the court accepts the Commonwealth's interpretation.
What's your best case or statute or rule to support your argument that this testimony was inadmissible?
Well, I cited the Vasquez case in my brief, which is a civil case. It's a wrongful death case. But in particular, you had a financial expert coming in to testify about a woman's life expectancy and what her earnings would be if she had worked to age 60 or 65. And that was important because what that financial expert had to do was guess. He had to essentially guess, if she lives to 60 and she takes care of her adult son for the next 30 years, this is how much she's going to make. I'm going to guess that if she becomes full-time employed, then she's going to make this over the life of 25 or 26 years. That's the same thing Dr. Lucky has to do. I'm going to guess that Mr. Zinner, or a normal person, stopped drinking at 5:50, roughly 1 hour before the accident. But at the end of the day,
she didn't say Mr. Zinner or a normal person. She said a normal person.
Exactly. But I think the testimony, as it was presented, and the only reason to present it, was to attribute it to Mr. Zinner. At this time, Your Honor, I'd ask to reserve my 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning. Donald Jeffrey on behalf of the Commonwealth. Before I get too far down the path here, I want to start out with saying that we certainly believe that any error was harmless in light of the overwhelming evidence of guilt. We do have the defendant's admission to the detective that he had nothing to drink in the interim, and he's found face down in the bushes, and as I think Judge Frank pointed out, the level of intoxication at the hospital approximately 7 hours later was extremely high.
Do you agree that the testimony was, in fact, inadmissible?
No.
In Virginia, an expert in a criminal case cannot testify except based on facts and evidence. That's clear.
Correct.
That's 8.01, and I forgot what the statute is. But this expert is testifying based on things that are not in evidence, what the average person's whatever is. That's not in evidence. So how could that be admissible?
I'm not sure. I think you're making a Simpson, I'm sorry, not making an argument. You're asking a Simpson-type question. And I'm not sure that argument was ever made. The argument that was made was about assumptions and methodology and reliability, and I think that's a slightly different argument. And let me take you...
Let me stop you with that one. You cite this, I think, in your brief, Kazee versus Donegan, which is a civil case. But in that case, the Supreme Court said this testimony was insufficient to lay a foundation for the admission of the challenged evidence because the probative value of that evidence rested on assumptions about Donegan that had no factual basis in the record. Thus, it was inadmissible. And then the court goes on to say, and it couldn't be harmless because he was the only expert to testify.
Correct.
Why isn't Kazee kind of the key to deciding this case?
Well, of course, Kazee is not a criminal case, so it's not responsive to your last question. But I think one of the things that you have to look at is that if you read that opinion in total, because I agree with the court. I mean, my first reading of Kazee was, wow, this is a problem. But I think if you read the entire opinion, the Supreme Court is very clear that the officer's name is Tuning. He did accident reconstruction testimony in Henrico for years. Officer Tuning specifically said, I'm putting this person in the average box. And I think that's the subtle distinction here. Our expert didn't ever do that here. She, in fact, as I think Judge Frank alluded to, admitted that essentially his blood alcohol could be lower based on these variables that I don't know about. So I think that's the subtle distinction. I would I marked that part of Tuning, but I think if you read Tuning early on, I think that... I'm sorry, Tuning is the name of the officer. If you read Kazee early on, it does seem to be on all fours. But then if you get into it deeper, it's that 1.5 second, I think, was the whole thing that was at issue there. It clearly says that Officer Tuning put that individual in that box and essentially said, I have no reason to doubt that this person is outside that box. That didn't happen here, and well, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Didn't the expert here testify that as to... They're defining it based on the average person.
Correct.
And she had no knowledge as to whether or not this defendant fit that box, as you say, of average person.
Correct. And that's...
But she said that these assumptions, I can't make the assumption because I don't have sufficient evidence.
Correct.
She said, I don't know when he had his last drink.
She did well. Yes, she did say that.
So my question was whether or not any place in the record says that this defendant had a blood alcohol between whatever at the time of the accident, because she didn't know what the variables were.
No, I don't think, if I understand your question correctly, I think it's consistent with some of the other questions you've asked earlier. She said, this is what happens with the average person, and she then made it very clear that there are some variables that I don't know here, essentially sort of the opposite of what Officer Tuning did in Kazee. And again, I think it's very subtle. I think I understand your question correctly.
If this testimony wasn't meant to apply to this defendant, it wouldn't even be relevant.
Well, and that's a point we made on brief. The relevance objection was never made in this case. And that might be a subtle distinction, but that objection was never made. It was the objection that was made was that she was making assumptions that weren't accurate or that there wasn't record evidence, and it was a methodology and reliability objection. It was not a relevance objection, Judge Petty. That's all I've got for you, because I think now we said this on brief, and remembering that it's an abuse of discretion standard with respect to relevance, I could pitch that to you all day, but I would acknowledge that could potentially be a problem.
I question why it was relevant in the first place, because he wasn't charged with driving while 0.08 or above, but that's not for me to say.
Yeah, except that, and you alluded to it a minute ago, I did look it up when you asked the question, whoever asked the question about the range. It was, the testimony was only to that 0.27 to 3.4, the extrapolated range. It was not lower. That's what, at least that was my quick reading at about page 250 of the appendix is where that testimony starts. But I think to that extent it is relevant because it certainly deals with how a person walks and talks and interacts and that sort of thing. So I think probably it has some...
I asked that question because if testimony as to the effects of a 0.34 on an individual was all you had, then the evidence that he was in fact a 0.34 would have to be established. If there was testimony about what a 0.27, I think 27, whatever, the lower number.
27 was the low end of the extrapolation range, not the chemical test.
It's actual, was it 2.1 actually?
2 over 2. I think they pegged it between 20 and 22. So you're right, that's sort of the midpoint. But the toxicology testimony, as I just read it a moment ago, was 0.27 and above. I think I've responded to the relevance question at least as best I can. I don't think that's before you. You know, I think it is important, if only to harmless error. I would point this out with respect to Kazee before I forget it. Unlike Kazee, and this was a bench trial, you did have a judge who was very much aware of the parameters and how the expert constrained her opinion based on those variables that she didn't know the answer to.
Well, was also only a one-sentence analysis of harmless error in Kazee's. It wasn't really an in-depth discussion of the concept.
And really, for all the reasons that the court said here, some of the things that were mentioned earlier, and the things that we mentioned on brief, with respect to the statements to the police, the evidence of the collision, there was the odor of alcohol at the scene that the husband who was driving, Mr. Kotke, detected. There was the defendant being found face down in the bushes and incoherent, et cetera, statements at the hospital, statements to the detective. We start this all on page 18 of the brief, and I think there is factually accurate things there. Overwhelming evidence of guilt, which I think would render any error here harmless.
Did the trial court in its conclusion refer to the doctor's testimony?
As I recall, she just said, akin to what opposing counsel said, that it, for all the reasons stated by the Commonwealth, of course.
And the Commonwealth did argue the expert's testimony.
I think that was argued. Now, I will make this point, Judge Frank. There was no separate motion to exclude the testimony. I mean, at the time this evidence came in, which is the relevant time frame, there was no objection along those grounds. And I don't think you can bootstrap by what I don't think the defense can bootstrap by what the Commonwealth did in closing argument, because that was the trial judge was never alerted to the playing field has essentially changed here, because now they're trying to make it defendant specific. I think that's a key point here. But I believe I only skimmed that, to be perfectly honest. If you'd like me to go back through that, I'd be glad to do it and write something for you. But I kind of take it face value that she did make some argument in that regard.
Yeah, I think there's a page 380.
That's my recollection. I didn't take copious notes on that part of the record.
No, I understand that.
And I don't want to inadvertently misstate it to you. You know, I would, not to beat a dead horse, because again, I think any error is harmless. This probably is not the case to make any grand pronouncements about retrograde extrapolation. The court knows that that's pretty important testimony in a lot of our cases in Virginia. On the sufficiency point, again, the statute that abrogated rushing says that the retrograde extrapolation is part of your analysis. I'd make that point again, 19.2, 324.1, I think. I would like to go back to some of the arguments that were made with respect to why this was unreliable, because I think you can sort of start to pick this apart. I'm sorry, page 6 and page 7 of the brief, and it talks about the three assumptions, and I think at least two of these are almost complete non-starters. I'll start with the second one, where the argument is that Lucky had to assume that the appellant was not an alcoholic and therefore eliminates alcohol at a rate of 0.01 to 0.02% per hour. If you look at her testimony, that disparity actually inured to the defendant's benefit, because at page 2, all right, I've lost the place. I think it's 265. She actually testified that alcoholics eliminate at a greater rate, so he would have actually gotten the benefit of the doubt on that. That's one of the two things, and I'm sorry, I think it's 265. I wrote it in my notes here, and I'm having trouble finding it right now, but if it comes to me, I'll find it. But and then with respect to the assumption that the appellant had no alcohol to drink, well, that's again based on the statement to Detective Jerry. Now, again, they try to say that that's lacks, shouldn't be given any weight. I don't think that, and they use, as part of that, they use the testimony of the defense expert in the case, who testified after this admissibility decision was made. This argument was never presented below, and I would suggest to you that you've got the foundational evidence for that part of it. So really, the only thing that you're left with is the first supposed assumption that was incorrect about the full absorption. And I would only point out that she ultimately testified that although we give individuals an hour, I believe this is at page 266 of the joint appendix, that we give individuals an hour to account for that, that really most people fully absorb within 15 to 20 minutes. And of course, at this point, we know he's left the bar from some point up the road. and driven a certain distance, and that all factors into it as far as why this, I think, becomes a weight versus admissibility decision. And the only other thing that I would point out, we cited some cases on brief. Again, I don't think this is the case to make the grand pronouncements about retrograde extrapolations.
Did you say that's admissible by statute, retrograde?
I don't believe I said that. I'm not aware of a statute on it. There may be.
That comes under the general rule of expert admissibility.
Correct. We did, if the court were to look at the merits of retrograde extrapolation and weight versus admissibility, we cited two cases that in particular I think make some good points on this. Again, probably not something you have to open up in this case. In Burgess, which is one of the cases we cited out of Vermont, it talked about making this more of a weight versus admissibility thing because you're talking about things that a defendant could voluntarily withhold, like the eating patterns and things like that. You know, allow the experts to be crossed on that type of thing, but that's information that's unique to the defendant.
You may be right on the case, I'll just say this as an observation. I still go back to what I said earlier, Simpson versus Commonwealth. Experts in criminal cases can only base their opinion on facts and evidence, and there seem to be a lot of assumptions in here that aren't in evidence. Argument for another day, perhaps.
Well, and I don't think that I don't think that this is a Simpson argument. I think that it really was a reliability argument, that she's making assumptions that aren't in the record. I would suggest to you, though, that on really probably all three of them, as I just pointed out, I think we've got enough record evidence somewhere in the record for the appellate court to look at it and say that stuff really is in the record. Might not have been at the time the admissibility determination was made. But if you narrow that window, even on that last point, which I would admit was probably the toughest one for us, that window narrows down to 15 or 20 minutes. And I think that's important. The Geis case, I think I'm pronouncing that right, which we said, which this is a fact that I think just slaps you in the face in this case if you ever get to the merits on it, which is that it's not like we're talking about, well, this could reduce this to 0.07. If you've got that 15 to 20 minute window, and let's assume he got in the bar, was drinking right up to the time he left, and it was 6 minutes till the accident, it would seem to me that that again becomes a weight issue. It's not like you have a fairly low BAC 7 hours later. That's, and I see I'm running out of time, mercifully probably, but I'll wrap up. I think that this testimony is important. The Burgess case makes the point, which is that they've got the same type of statute we do, where you have to get to the time of driving, which, as the court knows, is not unique in all states, and that's what makes it important. If the court has any other questions on the merits, I'll be happy to try to address those or any other issue.
Thank you.
Thank you. In the Commonwealth's brief, they specifically cite for harmless error that in order to determine whether there has been a fair trial on the merits and whether substantial justice has been reached, a reviewing court must decide whether the alleged error substantially influenced the fact finder. If it did not, the error is harmless. And during his argument, Your Honor pointed to page 379 and 380, where the Commonwealth made their arguments to the court, and the court basically adopted them as is. And on 379, the Commonwealth argued, using the retrograde extrapolation, Dr. Lucky testified that his BAC at the time of the accident would have been a range of 0.27 to 0.34, which keeps getting misconstrued. She said that to get to that BAC within an hour, you'd have to have 13 and a half to 17 drinks. But if you had been drinking over the course of several hours, it would be many more. So that number is something that is directly brought up to Judge Shockley before she makes her ruling. And Judge Shockley, on page 265, did her own questioning of Dr. Lucky at the very end, in which she specifically asked her, is it possible that that number of 0.20 or 22 at 1:54 a.m. could have been lower? And there's an exchange between the two in which Dr. Lucky ultimately says, I don't know. There are factors that she doesn't know. So I submit that if those assumptions were not present and we were able to verify them based upon actual facts and evidence, then the opinion would have been proper, but it was not. Thank you.
Thank you. We will be on a great council.